a morally ambitious person. And that's not something that you hear people talking about quite often in the world. Like when someone says to me, "Well, tell me what your goals are, aside from, writing books and being a public intellectual and being a very good teacher in the classroom," I often say to people, "I want to be morally ambitious." And they say, "What do you mean by you want to be morally ambitious?" I mean, I really want to become a better person. I think there are better people. I'm not an egalitarian. I do think that there are lesser people and that there are better people. And then you see raised eyebrows. And I think objectivism gives me that ammunition and that motivation. And by a better person or a morally ambitious person, I mean using my rational faculty, using reason to choose values, right? To choose values that suffuse my character, that will purchase a life of rational happiness. And when I say, you notice I didn't say happiness, because when people talk about happiness, their version of happiness seems episodic. It seems like something that's reigned of the moment, something that is short-lived. When I talk about happiness, I'm talking about happiness in the Aristotelian sense, happiness that can withstand tragedy, happiness that can trans that can withstand set mom episodic moments of sadness. That is happiness that is long-term, that can support a life that is marred by tragedy, marred by melancholy, marred by sadness. So happiness is a life that is purchased by the virtues of your character. And in order to purchase the virtues or to acquire the virtues of your character, you've got to understand what your human nature is all about. I mean, you can't do that by being a drug addict. You can't do that by being a sex addict. You can't do that by purchasing anti-values or doing things that are inimical to your nature as a human being. You have to do that by being consistent with your nature. And values are contextual, and that's a good thing about objectivism. It's sort of that values are very contextual. There's no one size fits all. So I happen to be someone who is a thinker and an artist, and I choose those values that suit my disposition and my orientation. So when I want what I when I say I want to become a better person, I mean I really want to become more rational. I want to use my mind to go about acquiring values, whether they're romantic partners or platonic friendships, the books that I read, the music that I love, the vacation spots that I choose, all involve my mind that act in accordance with who I am. That is not my whims, not my not by fiat, not by what Rand would call whim choosing by whims, but by something that can be sustained through time. Something that can be that is endurable, that lasts for a long, long time, that can carry it with me. And so when I look back at my life, it's not accidental that the values that I chose when I was 20 are still values that I hold at 56, because there are values that are consistent with who I am as a person. Now, some values change, and that's what it means about the contextuality of values, that as you grow and you evolve, you sometimes outgrow parts of yourself, and that's quite proper and appropriate. But to become a better person also means to enjoy your life to the best of your ability, because I do think that objectivism is right, that your highest moral purpose on this earth is to achieve your rational happiness, right? Not to make another person happy, but to make yourself happy. I couldn't think of a more beautiful goal in life than to achieve your happiness on this earth. If you want to make others happy, you've first got to be living optimally, to live a life of flourishing. And so that's my favorite part of objectivism.
I wanted to acknowledge we have the chairman of the board of the Atlas Society in the room, and one of the themes that he has challenged us to explore is gratitude. And not, as a Hallmark card platitude, but within an objectivist context, recognizing that in terms of our evolutionary nature, that we can overemphasize threats and negativity. That's how we evolved to survive. And in terms of our moral purpose of achieving happiness, that sometimes it is important to consciously take stock and reset our perspective in terms of what is going right, not just in terms of things that we can enjoy and be happy about, but also in terms of building up our sense of agency. I was able to get this thing going right in my life, then I actually have the ability, I'm capable of making improvements to better my situation. Scott, you have a question for Professor Hill.
Yes, I was just going to add quickly. Yes, I think there's something about showing kind of a gratitude to reality, just for life, and it's just part of the benevolent universe premise. But to Professor Hill, I've been following you and what's happened to you. I feel like, when they tried to cancel you for your comments, first about Israel and then for trans, it's just like, I feel like one, the lesson of that is that, it doesn't even matter if you're black or gay. If you, cross or an immigrant, if you cross the, left wing agenda, they're still going to find some excuse to come after you. And, but my question is more about if you think there's any place for like the liberty movement to get together against those that have been unfairly maligned by cancel culture, a kind of mutual defense pact.
Thanks, Scott. I do think so, but I think that the liberty movement and other movements that are committed to freedom and liberty have got to realize I think they often fight these battles piecemeal. And one of the things that I've said is that we cannot, those of us who are committed to liberty and freedom are too busy often swatting the bees, the little bees, the stinger bees, and we've got to go after the hives. Once you get the hives and you annihilate the hives and you kill the hives, then you've got the bees. And what I mean by that is that we've got to go to the foundations out of which these stinger bees, these busy bees, are inflicting damage. And so I think for an alliance to take place, there can be disagreements among the members of these alliance, and sometimes there's seemingly intractable differences among these members of these alliances. But we've got to agree upon a couple of things. Where are the hives, or who are the members of these hives? And I would say, our universities, for example, are bastions of, it's not even enough to call them left-wing orthodox. They're bastions of hatred of America, hatred of excellence, of achievement, of success, and of a commitment to rebrand America into a communist charnel house. And so we've got to agree, well, how do we combat the university system? How do we combat the teachers' union? How do we combat these hives? And so, yes, but quite often what frustrates me when I meet individuals, and they don't all have to be intellectual, is that they seem to be very busy, like attacking, spending too much energy attacking individuals like Ibram Kendi and, Robin DiAngelo, and attacking individuals as opposed to attacking the ideologies, okay, the philosophic systems that these individuals are parasitic upon. And so we need to attack the philosophic systems, which are the hives, basically, and destroy them. So when Kamala Harris, for example, gets up on television yesterday, as she did, and she says, you know, America, I'm writing an article on this, and it's called Genocide, Stolen Land, and Other Lies About America. And she says, we have to also remember that this country was built on stolen land, and she went on and on. And I wanted to say, no, you know, that's something that we have to talk about. There was no genocide in this country, and there was no stolen land. These are shibboleths that we have to debunk. There was a war for resources, and the Native Americans lost that war. They came in second. The British and the Americans had the technology to wipe out the Americans, the Native Americans, if they wanted to. If there was a genocide, there'd be no Native Americans living. And the 1924 Indigenous Act, which granted citizenship to Native Americans, is incompatible with a genocide. You don't grant citizenship to people that you intend to annihilate from the face of the earth. So, Scott, I agree with you. I think there are alliances that have got to be made. But I find among conservative movements, they operate like in their own curated silos, as opposed to the left that know how to really band together. And in spite of their differences, they know how to make stars out of mediocrities. Look at what they did. They gave that semi-literate idiot Ibram Kendi the MacArthur Genius Award. They gave Ta-Nehisi Coates, who can barely, you know, who's such a lugubrious, sentimental, mawkishly sentimental writer, the National Book Award. They know how to really galvanize among themselves and brand themselves. And I think people on the right or conservatives who stand for liberty often work. And it's part of the individualistic nature of conservatives. But yeah, I think you're right.
What it reminds me of is what's been happening recently with some of the airlines, Southwest, now American, where individuals have a disagreement with a government mandate and they are discovering their power to take a page from Ayn Rand and shrug and kind of go galt. And there's been similar movements with regards to the universities, to the extent, you know, we identify them, as you mentioned, as hives, as, you know, sources of infection, to encourage large donors to withdraw their many millions of dollars that they give to their alma maters as a way of finding leverage. There's Peter Thiel's efforts to encourage young people to pursue a different path than necessarily the college.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, I mean, I've been writing about for years now about defunding the universities and shutting down the social science and the humanities departments. It's not going to happen with this administration, but I've written articles, and in my previous book, I have a whole chapter devoted to, you know, defunding the social sciences, because there's no reason why taxpayers should be funding their destroyers, why businessmen and women should be funding universities in which professors, the professoriate, and students are claiming that they're imperialistic colonizers and that they're racist capitalists. This is just crazy. I mean, I can't think of any situation in which the funders of these universities are funding their, as Rand would say, funding their destroyers. So I'm in complete agreement with that. And I would say, you know, shut down the government schools also, because they're purveyors of hatred. They're using critical race theory as a school, as a tool to spread hatred and divisiveness in this country. And as I said in an article that I wrote recently, it's critical race theory is a way of murdering the souls of white children. By telling them that just by possessing white skin, they're walking practitioners of systemic oppression, and leaving black people to feel as if they are their agency has been expropriated and as if they're completely helpless, which is a dangerous phenomenon that has arisen in the third iteration of critical race theory.
Yes. So I wanted to also let everyone know we're going to record this session again as part of our effort to integrate our different platforms and get more of our audience from Instagram, from our newsletter, from Facebook, to just give them a taste of what's going on here so that they can join. Let's go to another question here that you chose, Professor Hill, from at Hamish Whiteside, who asked, views on if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear, which I think it's interesting whether you take that in the context of, you know, the whole national security and intrusions on citizens' privacy, or just your kind of own personal ethics of not keeping secrets or hiding things that that you would not want to come into the light of day.
Right. I thought that was a great question because I think this is one of the canards that that is sort of almost coin of the realm in our culture today. You know, if you have nothing to hide, then you have nothing to fear. And I think this is this this notion of that if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear, is really an issue of what we could call context dropping. You know, look, sometimes we do have rational reasons to hide things and information that others have no rational reasons to have access to. Because if they did have access to them, they would use that information to harm us and destroy us. There are evil people in the world. There are despotic, totalitarian governments that invade our privacy and demand that we hand over information that they have no business having access to. And then they use that information to punish us or to kill us sometimes. And so there is a rational reason to hide from people information that they have no business having in the first place through a violation of our privacy, or just even getting rid of the notion of privacy. It's none of their business. And we have a rational reason to keep private that which in our own name belongs to us. So I wanted to talk about the issue in which outside of a particular context, we cannot make blanket statements like if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. And also on the other end of the spectrum, the idea also is that fear can be a rational emotion. I mean, this is another issue of context dropping, that sometimes fear is an irrational emotion. And sometimes fear is a very, very rational emotion. Outside of a particular context, one cannot make a blanket statement that if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. Sometimes we do have rational reasons for fearing. The reason that nature endowed us with the emotion of fear is that it is a survival technique. I think, for example, that we all should be fearful of losing our republic. Now, what we do with that fear is a different issue. If the fear itself is paralyzing, and if it is not a catalyst for action, that is, if the fear is so paralyzing that we are left inert and we can't do anything, then that's a different issue. If a gunman is holding a gun to my head and demanding me my money, and I have reason to think that he could kill me, that's a rational fear. Now, how I respond to that gunman is going to be very interesting. I might, you know, that's where the use of reason and equanimity and calmness, or if I think I can fight him off, or, you know, in the immediacy of that moment, there are a multiplicity of choice options that are available to me. But fear can be a rational emotion. And it also can be an irrational moment. Sometimes we fear things that in reason and when you appraise a situation or a context, there is no reason to be fearful at all. An independent outsider can just say one is exhibiting irrational fear. But it one needs a particular context, I think, in order to make the assessment that whether fear is rational or fear is irrational. But the view that if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear, I think presupposes the notion that, let me say as a philosopher, the famous quote, all things being equal, that is, there being no nefarious and forces to damage my agency or to damage my person, if the display of some content of my personality or some part of my life is not going to be met with threats or with damages against me, if it's an honest and so let's use my example, you know, I'm a gay person. If I'm in Uganda, certain parts of Uganda or certain parts of Jamaica, where I'm from, I certainly have good reason to hide that because I could be killed. Now, in Lincoln Park, or where I live in Chicago, which is pretty open and accepting place, I have nothing to hide because there are very few people who will kill you, if any at all, in Lincoln Park, Chicago, by being gay. So I have nothing to hide and I have nothing to fear. In that particular context, the statement makes sense. If you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. If you tell the truth in a free society, Jennifer and others, and your First Amendment is protected, and you tell the truth, then you have nothing to fear, because there's no such thing as a political crime if you exercise your First Amendment. I think this is a very interesting question, because I think we're living in a society now where the First Amendment is being canceled, and by telling the truth, like every one of us in this room emerged from the legs of a woman, as Dave Chappelle recently said, therefore, sex and gender are indisputable truths. So you say that publicly. I'm probably going to get in trouble for saying that. But all of us emerged from the birth canal of a woman, or if we were delivered by cesarean, it means that we emerged from a biological woman whose reproductive apparatus she was in possession of, means that biological sex is real. You say something like that, and you can lose your job. So people are hiding something because they have a legitimate reason to fear. I'm spending a lot of time on this topic because it's bandied about in a very careless fashion. If you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. Sometimes you should hide things because you do have legitimate reason to fear for your life based on the context of the situation. The United States of America is becoming the kind of country where if you dare to speak the truth in certain contexts, you have reason to fear for losing your job, your livelihood, and sometimes even your life.
So we have a few people in the queue. Calum, I'm going to get to you, but we also, if you don't mind waiting just a bit more, we have Jay LaPere, who's the chairman of the board of the Atlas Society, running a multi national company. So we're going to get to his question yet next, and then I'm going to get the rest of you that raised your hand up on the stage. So, Jay?
Yes. Can you hear me okay?
Yep,
great. Jason, fabulous answer on objectivism and what was most meaningful. Really, really great context on all of that. The question I have is, a huge percent of the people are influenced by the woke ideology, for lack of a better way to describe it, but they're well-intentioned and they're just ignorant. And you deal with students. What do you find, if anything, that's most effective in helping them to begin the journey of thinking, for lack of a better description? Because it really is a process. It doesn't happen overnight, but their brains have been filled with so many foundational assumptions about morality and ethics and justice. So thoughts on that?
Yeah, thanks, Jay. I think the situation is becoming worse, Jay. I think that 5 years ago, many of them were ignorant. And ignorant in by default, in the sense that they just didn't have information that needed to be forthcoming in order to relieve their ignorance. So I guess it would be what Rand would call, they would make errors of knowledge, because the normative knowledge that they needed to have. What I have found in the classroom is something much, much more disturbing. People are not just willfully ignorant, they are willfully ignorant. They don't want to know. They are what Aristotle would call guilty of affected ignorance. They're not just blind, they're willfully blind. I have presented evidence. So let's just take the whole gender trans issue. I got into serious trouble in the classroom and was reported because I said something on the order of, I'm making a comment about Plato saying that philosophy is the mother of all sciences. And a student said, "You cannot say that, Professor Hill, because trans men are giving birth to babies." And I said, "Men are not giving birth to babies." And the student said, "Well, trans men are giving birth to babies." And I said, "Well, let's be clear. When a trans man gives a birth to baby, it's a biological woman." And I all hell broke loose. And I said, "Let's calm down." And I gave all the scientific evidence. They didn't want to hear it. This is a case where politics and political ideology are trumping facts. So this is a very serious situation where students, in order to protect their political sensibilities, in order to protect their political ideologies, are willfully, willfully ignoring the facts. And how to get around that phenomenon is very, very difficult. There are a handful now of students whose minds can be changed, who are well-intentioned, as you say, and are open to reason and rational persuasion. But there are an increasing number of ideologues for whom truth and evidence themselves are constructs of white racist imperialists, and the very attempt to convince them is an attempt. This is how bad it's gotten in academia, in the education system. The very attempt to convince them by logic, by evidence, is an attempt to use the language and the methodology of the oppressor. Those students and their professors are enemies of the state. I don't know what to do about them. I encounter them more and more frequently. I think they're really, really problematic. I think the only lesson that they will learn is from reality, because you can't really fake reality. But in terms of what I can do, I don't think I can do anything. I can just continue to present the evidence calmly, dispassionately, rationally, and watch them turn against it. But I think reality ultimately will be their teachers. But I want to just emphasize, Jay, how increasingly common is this phenomenon where students are willfully turning away from evidence that will force them to re-examine their political commitments and their woke commitments. This is very, very increasingly common in the universities.
Thank you. That's very helpful, because it frames the first question, which is, are you interested in the facts? But that helps. Maybe when they shut down the Starbucks and they can't get a decaf latte, that reality will kick in. Thanks.
Yeah, and Jason, I know you have given examples from your classroom in the past where you would assign philosophy texts or certain books, and the students would prefer to take a failing grade rather than actually even read the texts. And these weren't, you know, exactly far right-wing texts. I mean, they were things that when I went to Columbia, they were considered, you know, part of the freshman year standard reading list of the things that you would read. So we have a few other people. Caleb, I want to thank you for your patience. Do you have a question for Professor Hill?
Hi. thank you, Professor Hill. I very much enjoy hearing your voice on a lot of the social issues that this country is currently going through. I actually had a question. I recently heard an interview with Caitlin Flanagan, another person whose voice I very much respect. And she seemed to take a rather pessimistic view of the hopes for our country going forward based upon what is going on now, even going so far as to believe that we have a few decades left before we collapse due to the way things have been going. I'm curious if you have a similar pessimistic view or if you have a more hopeful view for the future of this country. Thank you.
Well, as the months go by, I'm not a pessimist by nature. I'm an optimist by temperament. But as the months go by, I actually think that we have already collapsed, and that America, the edifice and the structure of this country and of this civilization was so strong that we're simply living on the remnants. And what I see my job, what I see as my job, is really teaching a cadre of soldiers, of lieutenants, of future commanders in chief, who will rebuild the muck and the putrefaction and the debris and the junk has really started to rot. We've already collapsed, as far as I'm concerned. We're living on the remnants of a very, very strong civilization. When I walked into a bookstore and just out of curiosity, I saw a book called, it was an octopus facing a little girl, and the name of the book was Not Opposites, Just Different, We're All Equal. And I asked the store manager, I said, what is this? Is this book selling? He said, it's our top selling book, right? So there's no lower place to go in terms of intellectual obscenity when you have a best-selling book in which an animal is being where children are being told, just think about our future, that, you know,
don't tempt them to get worse.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to get worse. And but I'm hopeful that in the DNA of this country, Americans are survivors. And what gives me hope, Caleb, is that we're seeing the pushback by parents who are shocked at what their children are being taught. Not just in terms of critical race theory, but in terms of the hatred of this country, in terms of the gender stuff that is being pushed on young boys, the non-binary stuff that is being foisted on children. Parents are shocked, and this is part of how communists invoked their revolution. Instituted their revolution by deceiving children, teaching children to report what was being said at home. And when you have a situation like in the New York public school systems, where teachers are sending letters to parents saying, "Do not gender your child, because we are not going to gender your child in the classroom." And the students are being told that if their parents gender them to come back, you can Google this. They're being told to tell the teachers that they're being gendered in school, and the parents are horrified. There's going to be a serious backlash, and my hope rests on that backlash, on that recognition, that realization. So I think in the long run we might be fine, but I think we're going to suffer and see some horrible, horrible things. People's lives are going to be ruined, careers are going to be destroyed before we see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Thank you, Professor Hill. And I want to, first of all, thank everyone for making this AMA Ask Me Anything a success. We've got a little over 20 minutes, so I do want to set expectations as we're having people. I'm seeing your hands raised. I'm calling on you. But just to set expectations, we might not be able to get to everyone because I've only booked Professor Hill for this hour. I think I would add to his comments about pessimism versus optimism and where we stand now to also take into account the exponential accelerating changes that we're seeing in technology, which is opening up new spheres of discussion, of commerce, of social exchange. And I think that is a positive and mitigates against the kind of control that we face. And while that octopus book sounds very disturbing, I think we can also take heart from, you know, the best-selling books are usually those on the right. So that is something to keep in mind. So, Martin, you've been patient. Thank you very much. Do you have a question for Professor?
I do. Thank you, Jennifer. And thanks for this great room. And you kind of just sort of segued into what I want to ask. And it does pertain back to what Professor Hill was saying in regards to privacy earlier. You made a really great case that I 100% agree with about why we should be concerned about our right to privacy, even if we have nothing to hide. I'd like to just take the perspective to the side a little bit and turn it back on the loss of privacy and ask not what it means to me or what it means to us to have our own privacy abrogated in that way, but that we are allowing power to be amassed by those who are taking our privacy. And Jennifer mentioned new technology, and we now have tech companies that are gathering data on all of us, and it may not concern us as to how it pertains to our own life, but they are amassing power that feels as if it is outside the purview of the Constitution. It's a private sector abrogation of our rights, or at least it could be. And so my question is, and forgive me if this is an ignorant question because I don't really call myself an objectivist, but what is the objectivist perspective on what essentially amounts to private sector threats to our rights?
Well, Jennifer, I'm probably going to defer that question to you there. My sense is that my immediate response would be that as we ratify the actions of Facebook and Instagram and YouTube to make these incursions against our privacy, because they're private companies, and we, through our choices, we ratify the actions when we engage as social users, and we voluntarily give our information to these private organizations, knowing full well that they can sell that information, that they can disclose that information to third party and fourth party and fifth party, including China and foreign countries. But to get back to the more immediate point, when we become signatories to these social outlets, we know full well that we are disclosing voluntarily the information, that when we turn on our location and we say, hey, I'm at, you know, the Marriott having dinner with Joey, and we turn on our location, we ought to know, or we should know full well what's involved in giving away our location, that and what's involved in giving away our dining preferences and all that comes with it. But Jennifer, I'll probably let you talk about the official objectivist perspective on that.
I am going to in turn defer to Robert Trusinski, who we have in this space on Tuesday, who's written a lot about that theme, because I want to make sure that we don't scant some of the other people that we have in the room. But Martin, great question. Anson.
I primarily want to endorse something that Dr. Hill said about his travails as a teacher. Not in my bio, but I decided when I left the workforce start substitute teaching STEM subjects in high schools. And I did so over a course of 10 years in two different school districts within the state in which I lived. And I confronted a situation that just astounded me. The lack of will to learn is the way Dr. Hill expressed it. And I would even go so far as a total rejection, arrogantly, and sometimes with quasi-violence, a rejection of learning. It amazed me, but I stuck with it for 10 years, and finally I left in moderate disgust. During that time, early on, I looked, and I have my bio reflects considerable STEM education, and I looked into what it would take to become a certified teacher. And that, too, amazed me because I got an insight about how we teach teachers, budding college students, to be teachers. All of my academic credentials were fine. I didn't need to take any courses in chemistry, physics, math, or those types of things. But I would have been required to take 40 hours of how to write a lesson plan, substitute teaching, and all the periphery that goes along with gaining one certification as a teacher.
Wow, that's amazing. Anthony, I'm going to
close by saying, okay. I believe that the failure of our public education system, it's been going on since the 1960s, and it is the greatest threat to the American people that we confront today.
Thank you. Ned, did you have a question for Professor Hill? We've got about 15 more minutes.
Yeah. Hi, I'll keep this quick. Jennifer, thanks for doing this. Professor Hill, nice to encounter you again. One of my favorite people to hear on here. I am wondering if you could talk a little bit about the role of comedy and ridicule in defeating some of these ideas, because some of them are just so dumb and silly. When we talk, you know, multiracial whiteness or whatever else. I know there's some interesting history around the KKK losing steam in this country, for example, because it's some of its shibboleths were exposed on the Mickey Mouse Club, and kids started using their passwords and stuff in a non-racial context, but just, you know, exposing just how dumb that was. How do we make more jokes about this kind of stuff? I think people have a good way of pushing back and saying, oh, you're making fun of X group, even though that's just not the case. So how do we ridicule it? Because I think ridicule is a really important way to expose just how dumb something can be without insulting actual populations of people or the really good aspects of progress and social justice.
I'm so glad you asked that, Ned, because I am not a comedian, although in private I am a comedian with my friends, but, you know, I'm an intellectual. But I was so happy that Netflix did not cancel Dave Chappelle, because I will say that in the division of moral labor, and I do regard comedians as performing a moral task, work has to be done on multiple levels. We can't all be like Susan Sontag and the Jason Hales of the world that are serious with gravitas. And so, you know, I mean, we do need humor. And Ned, I completely agree with you. We need to trivialize and to debunk and to make fun of some of these idiots and to undermine the spirit of seriousness of some of these people who are prating about their ideologies as if they're unassailable truths. So I think in the division of labor, you know, there are people like myself and other intellectuals who need to show the logical fallacies and the infelicities of these positions. But yes, we do need the comedians to come out and laugh, and especially young people who are susceptible and to reach those young people so that they might be then open to the more serious and high-minded arguments, when through comedy they've already that self-righteousness that they have, that moral fervor and that they come in with, can be diffused by comedy. So I think you're right. We need more comedians and to support their platforms and to make sure that they're not canceled.
Thanks for asking, Professor.
That's a great question, Ned. We also have in the room Patrick Riesenover, who's my creative partner in the animated drama My Life, videos, which, you know, sometimes can draw a little flack from some of the more staid corners of the objectivist movement, but they're funny. They're irreverent. My name is Cancel Culture, which we made the supervillain into a balloon boy, is an example of that. The memes that we post on our Instagram, Atlas Society, and Facebook are often pretty silly. And sometimes I'm like, oh my God, this is the dumbest thing. And our team says, yeah, but you're not the target audience. So I think that's great. One of my favorite accounts on Twitter recently has been a very concerned COVID parent. And it is just a spoof thread. It's just somebody pretending to be a unhinged zero COVID fanatic, vaccine fanatic. And that is another way. I'd love to see somebody brave enough to do some more spoof accounts like that on some of these even more hot topic themes. So Douglas, you have a question for Professor Hill?
Yeah, I have three very small ones, the short ones. The first one was, Professor Hill, did you just liken yourself to Susan Sontag?
No, I likened myself not to her. I would never be so presumptuous as to liken to her. She has a certain gravitas about her, a certain seriousness that I was equating that kind of seriousness. But
I was just joking. I was going to say, because if you did, then you are a comedian. I was trying to get my joke out. But in any event, two quick questions. The first is, you mentioned this octopus book as somehow this harbinger of, I don't know, some sort of moral, political, so forth decline. I don't know what type of decline. Why is it the octopus book and just the fact that, like, bookstores themselves aren't around like they used to be? I guess my question has to do with, like, people home in on the issues, like a particular ideology that they don't like and say this is the problem, when there seems to be a larger culture of anti-intellectual, anti-reading, anti-thinking more generally, which seems to be a much bigger problem than an individual book that a four-year-old might pick up and never remember. So what about just the larger anti-intellectual culture, anti-scientific culture, anti-school culture that pervades the country across ideological lines? That's my first question.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I've talked about the anti-intellectual nature of and the cultural bankruptcy and the intellectual bankruptcy of this country to no end. But I do think there's something grossly anti-intellectual about the speciesism argument that is being forced down the throats of young people that they are not likely to forget. But it's a huge part. It's not a book that a child is likely to forget. It's part of the curriculum of the K-12. That is the idea that speciesism is an evil and that there are no moral or qualitative distinctions between human and animals. It's part of the ecological movement that is at the heart of K-12 education, that human beings are not superior to animals, that there are no qualitative distinctions between animals, that the idea that to take the to sacrifice a baboon to save a human being is murder has broad implications for the future of humanity, that blurring the distinctions between animal life and human life has serious implications for our civilization. That's the point I wanted to get across. So that is a movement that is meant to deaden thinking. And but I think you're right. I mean, I think the anti-intellectualism that is part of this culture and part of the bankruptcy of this culture, that is symptomatic of it. It's not the cause of it. It's just a symptom of it. And we see many, many iterations of the anti-intellectual strand, which means that people don't think through issues very carefully. So I'm not just picking on, I just picked on that one book as part of sort of the intellectual poison that is being, or the anti-intellectual poison, well, call it intellectual poison that is being fed to our young people in the name of anti-speciesism, blurring the distinction between, and you see it in people like Greta Thunberg, right, who says we need to get back to nature, which means we need to live on the level of tsetse flies, man-eating tigers, and go back to primordial jungle swamps. She says that we need to cut back on productivity. We need to cut back on economic growth. We need to cut back and go back. It's what Rand called the the return of the primitive, the anti-industrial revolution. These radical ecologists, I call them eco-fascists, are part of the anti-intellectual, I would label them as part of the anti-intellectual trends sweeping this country.
Okay. So Anson just said that he substitute taught, and while he was substitute teaching, the students could barely pick up basic concepts in various scientific fields, but you believe that they'll be able to maintain a political ideology of anything that ranges from eco-fascism to speciesism. I don't know. I'm an educator as well. I also teach at the college level. And like, I'm trying to get my students to like write topic sentences and like construct arguments. And I just think a lot of this stuff is, I don't know, I don't see it. But here's the other question, it's very quick. So how much, I mean, and be very honest with yourself. And I think we could all be honest, let's ask me anything. How presentist are we being? I've heard you talk about the danger of communism and all this stuff on the left. Like there was a time in this country, 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, when there was an actual communist party. You had people who were self-professed communists running for president, getting votes. They were backed by a communist country, another superpower. But like when I hear people like you speak like the United States has never had this so-called radical left. When I would argue that the United States is not nearly as left as it was in the first half of the 20th century. So like how presentist, I mean, this is just, we want to be swept up in history. It's like in football, you watch a quarterback, although that's not fair. Tom Brady is the greatest of all time, but you watch a running back, you say, well, this is an all time great, but you're just saying that because you're there. I'm just looking at American history and I'm thinking, man, in the 30s and 40s, we had actual communists running around, actual communists
in Congress now.
Whom, Scott? Who are you talking about? Who in Congress, Scott, is calling for the end of private property, Scott?
I mean, you actually have people like Elizabeth Warren talking about breaking up Amazon.
Yeah, you know who else is talking about that, Scott? Josh Hawley and Rand Paul. What are you talking about?
Yeah, they
about?
Have That's different not communism. Reasons. I mean, it's an unfair question anyway to come in That's here not, and say, well, be
wait,
honest
Jason
with yourself.
Hill
you be honest
me.
With yourself.
All right,
Jason
guys,
Hill,
I'm gonna,
ask me anything, not ask
Jennifer, Jennifer, I wanted to thank you for bringing me up.
Yes, I'm going
to. I wanted to thank you for bringing me up to the stage. And I also want to say hi to Professor Hill.
Yeah, we've got 4 more minutes. So, Douglas, I think it was a fair question. You didn't ask me anything. Jason, do you want to bring us out in 3 minutes?
I want Greg to ask this question because I think communism was not mainstreamed in the 1960s, and it's mainstreamed right
now.
When I came to
the 30s and 40s, Dr. Hill, well, it was mainstream.
Well, no, it wasn't. Anyway, let's get
DPUSA. You don't know what you're talking about. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, I appreciate you ceding the mic, and I wanted to thank Jennifer first and foremost for bringing Jason and the Atlas Society together. As always, I've listened to a few of these conversations. Great. I'm just going to very briefly say that Ned asked a pertinent question to Jason, and Jason's response about comedy and humor was really important. I think we need more of that. So I thank Douglas for the extremely jovial comment about the fact that there was more communist ideology in the earlier parts of this century.
There was in the United States. You don't read history. That's fine.
And just very briefly, I think it's really important that we remember to have a civil discourse, attack arguments, not people. And the emotional tenor of the Atlas Society is always quite marvelous. So thank you, Jennifer, and thanks.
And
thank you,
telling me that I don't know what I'm talking about is more, I'm not a statistician. I've got a trivia, so I won't respond to it. And I don't believe in taking minutiae up to the level of metaphysical speculation. I know what I'm talking about.
Why did Congress pass a law against communism in the early 50s if it wasn't a big?
Yeah, that's all I'm going to.
Yeah, because you didn't know that either, did you?
Okay. Well,
you know,
thank
get
you,
off, get off the
Douglas.
Damn stage, you idiot.
Get off my nuts. How about that?
So that is going to get you moved back to the audience, Douglas. And we are going to have these twice a week on Tuesdays and on Thursdays. But to the point that Greg just made, we do want to try to maintain a certain level of civility and comity in these, so that we can try to keep the conversation on a productive level. I want to apologize to Nori, and I wasn't able to get to you, but I want to encourage you to come back on Tuesday. We're going to be talking to Robert Trusinski, who just recently joined the Atlas Society as a senior fellow. And I also want to encourage you guys to take a look at our website, atlassociety.com. I know Martin mentioned that he's sort of new to objectivism, so you'll find a lot of resources there, our pocket guide to objectivism, and my video intro course to objectivism. So take a look at that. We're also going to have next week a current events panel with, I believe, Professor Salzman and also Professor Stephen Hicks, if not also our founder, David Kelly. So thank you all for joining. I'm going to end the room, but I also want to just encourage any of you who are in the Southern California area to check out our gala, which is coming up on November 4th. We're honoring Peter Thiel. And we're also going to have Palmer Luckey, the founder of Oculus, as a speaker. So see you guys on Tuesday. Thanks.